Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have another Empowerment Hour, the latest on health and healing. I'm going to give you information about how a nutrient can help slash cancer of the skin. Also, what happens when girls take too little vitamin D? Big problem. For all the women in the audience, heart disease is more deadly for you than men. What can you do to stop that and to prevent heart disease? I'll deal with that. A new study shows how high-fat diets actually increase our risk of colorectal cancer. What can we do about that in a good way? And also the pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L, pycnogenol, that's French maritime pine bark. It improves menopausal symptoms, and I'll explain why. Plus, today I will get to part one of an ongoing series, an in-depth original investigative reporting piece that has taken, I guess, about 7 years of research to put together. It is now ready, and I'm prepared to share it with you. Not all at once. It would just be overwhelming. Maybe once a week, once every other week. Today, the Politics of Medicine presented research written by myself and Dr. Nancy Ashley, one of our scholars and residents on staff, followed by approximately 7 minutes of a whistleblower who was extremely successful helping the pharmaceutical industry manipulate doctors into prescribing drugs that were neither safe nor effective. Then, time permitting, I wish to get to an issue of the day, and this will be our issue that I'm going to ask you to call in on. I believe that we must be honest without any protection of our ideologies, our backgrounds, or our body politics. We simply must ask a simple question. Are we now in a police state? Are we engaged in fascistic politics? Have we intentionally and with malice aforethought began the process of deconstructing the Bill of Rights, the constitutional protections, and the ethics of how people should deal with the state, with each other, and the state and the bureaucracies deal with we, the citizens? I will start a 20-part series. Today, my own commentary with that of Professor Henry Giroux from Truthout. And I'm going to begin with four fundamentalisms and the politics that I believe we should begin our journey on. This will be a more scholarly approach, and I'm going to ask you, please call in afterwards and share your points of view. For those of you who do not have internet and need or want to listen to this radio program at least 7 hours a week, actually you could listen, yeah, for seven, I'm on 15, you can now with new technology, and this is exciting, you can listen over your telephone. There are a lot of older people or people who simply don't have means or understand the significance of the internet, and they have a telephone. I'll give you a number that you can call at noon each day, Monday to Friday. Sunday evening, you can call 8 to 9, and Monday evening for the Progressive Commentary Hour, 7 to 8. That number is 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. Also, on some stations, and we're carried all over the United States and about to be carried into 26 major markets with my new television program, which I hope will premiere tomorrow. So if you have a computer, you can watch now, but tomorrow you'll see the whole new staging, monitors, almost 17 different cameras showing people working on different projects. It'll be fun. And that will hopefully, we're supposed to get it all done today. But anyhow, we'll be preempted for 2 days on some of the Pacifica stations for International Women's Day, which is an important thing, but I will still be doing my programs live, so you can go to the internet, to my station, or call, if you don't have internet, 832-280-0066, and you can continue listening to the program. Now to the latest in the areas that are important for all of our health. First up, ever wonder how those meat packages that have the ham and the bologna and a lot of this stuff, how's that all held together? Well, according to Heather Callahan from Activist Post, glue. Meat glue. Did you ever hear of meat glue? I'd never heard of meat glue. Quote, "My meat contains what? Why didn't I know? More than likely, we have all consumed a substance called transglutaminase, or TG, from delis and possibly restaurants. Basically, a glue is used to piece together scraps of meat to sell as a whole cut. The glue's lines are invisible to the naked eye. Stories about glue in our meat are cropping up everywhere, causing great dismay. If there was ever a time that people should shout Franken in front of food, it's now. And literally as scraps from other parts of the animal or different animals are combined to create a seamless whole. Now, Japan's Animoto company produces the product called Activia, A-C-T-I-V-A, Activia. The TG, or thrombane, is a coagulation of protein mixed with fibrin. A glue enzyme is developed which permanently binds meat pieces together. This coagulant made of blood, and not just any blood, they use blood from cows and pigs and chickens, and also some kind of strange fermentation of bacteria. Well, that's yummy, isn't it? Gee whiz, can't wait to have my fermented blood. And here are some reasons why you should be concerned. First, there's low-quality food. Reassembling scraps is one more way for food producers to sell low-quality meat. Meat glue is certainly a boon to various parts of the meat industry who wouldn't otherwise be able to sell you snouts and ears and tails and testicles and genitalia. So the next time you walk in, just ask for, give me a sandwich of genitalia and put a little anus glue all stuck together, because that's exactly what you're eating. No labels. Isn't that sweet? They don't have to tell you, just like genetic engineering. Meat glue is never labeled because it's not considered part of the formulation of the product, meat. So that's what you're getting, and the FDA thinks it's just great. Well, now you know. And by the way, yesterday someone from downstairs called up and says, "Gary, turn on this food channel." And I did. And here's a guy eating in a restaurant. That I don't know his name. The bald-headed, overweight guy who goes around and eats these strange concoctions all over the world. And what's his name? Andrew Zimmerman. All right. Andrew, got your health insurance paid up? I would, if I were you. So he's eating in this kitchen where there's some soul food. Well, this will put you in touch with your soul real quick. I hope you believe in the afterlife, because they were tripe and chitlins. Do you know what that is? Well, here's how they described it, and he is correct. They skinned off this chicken skin, and then they deep fry it, all right, and then they put some kind of sauce on it. Do you have any idea what's in the skin of a chicken? The bacteria and the viruses and the parasites? Well, just look at a chicken, take its feathers off, and ask yourself, do you really think that's yummy? In any case, but that's not the bad part of this story. The bad part is they started to eat this special stew. And, well, yeah, we take the intestines of the pig out, and, you know, and then we add in some different spices and make this sauce. And, boy, he said something to the effect of, you know, you can, they don't clean it all out. You know, you can really taste it. Taste it? Yeah, kind of melts in your mouth. Hello, what exactly is melting in your mouth? What's melting in your mouth is the content of intestines of a pig. Now let's see, what could that be? Could that be apples or grapefruit? No, it's called defecation. It's body defecation. It's what the pig eliminates throughout the day, comfortably and without problem. And what you do, sometimes not so comfortably, with a great deal of problem, especially if you haven't had your fiber. Oh, my God! And that's how Reader's Digest became famous, because they could sit there for half a day before they actually were able to get their debris out, because they were so constipated. That means that any of you in the South, or any of you watching this dish being eaten and think, oh, I'd like to make that, well, do you really want disease-causing bacteria, E. coli? Remember, that's why every restaurant in America has, employees must wash their hand, because even a trace of it, a smudge of that, is enough to kill you. So why care about a smudge when you can eat it in a dish? In a southern dish, in a yummy southern dish, according to this guy. I watched this and I thought, oh my goodness, we can't be that dumb. Oh yeah, we can, with an attitude. So much for that. For those of you taking antipsychotic medication, there really is no reason to. We have holistic psychotherapists and psychologists and psychiatrists, orthomolecular psychiatry. We have even life coaches who are better able to help you than your traditional official psychiatrist. They're going to give you antipsychotics. Here's the latest on this. This is from the British Medical Journal. A study suggests that 180,000 people with dementia taking antipsychotic medication, 1,800 of them died. Quote, antipsychotic deaths charted in dementia patients. Now, understand something. Dementia patients rarely understand what they're taking because they have dementia. They lose ability to understand, remember. But these are extremely dangerous, and they do nothing, absolutely nothing, that other non-toxic natural therapies, even nutritional therapy, could do and help the person with dementia, and even reverse dementia. We've reversed dementia. They haven't. So keep them away from that wherever possible. Also, vitamin A. It can slash skin cancer risk, according to this new study published in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology. Quote, we found a protective effect from supplemental vitamin A, more than we could get from a multiple vitamin. And that was from Kaiser Permanente, Northern California. So, this was published in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology. Vitamin A each day. Vitamin D, if you don't take enough of it, if you're a girl, you risk stress fracture. This is in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine, published by the American Medical Association, and they show that we need more vitamin D in young girls to help their bones stay hard and grow. And heart disease in women is more deadly. One of the things women have to understand is you frequently hear about, well, I had a little chest pain, there was some pain up around my neck, coming down my shoulder, across my chest. Not so. More often than not, you will have no symptoms whatsoever before you have your heart attack or stroke. The Kalispell Regional Medical Center's report in the Heart Health Fair showed that a lot of women, high percentage of women, have heart disease and don't know it. And the older you get, the more likely you are to have heart disease. And if you are 60 or older, 92% of women have some form of vascular disease. 92% who are 60 and over. How many is that right now? It's over 50 million women. Well, 50 million women at risk of dying or having a heart attack or stroke. Shouldn't we have a national anti-hypertension or anti-heart disease a program nationally? Yes, we should. Well, we don't. We won't. But we're going to do something about it. When I return from my trip of filming, some very important information for not any new documentary, those are all done, but one that will be coming out a year from now, I am going to start in all the cities this show is broadcast, which is a lot of cities, I'm going to start a national women's health protocol and offer it weekly, and then be able to get feedback from women who are on the protocol of reversing high blood pressure, reversing angina, and anything else that could harm a woman. To know that 92% of women over 60 suffer from some form of heart disease, which puts them at risk of dying or injury, this we should be addressing. This is a major national issue, so we will deal with it. And now we know, according to the latest Cancer Research and Molecular Biology report and published in Cancer Prevention Research, how a high-fat diet increases colorectal cancer. And really, it's what we've been saying all along. Let me explain this. When you take in any form of fat, especially that which produces inflammation, that's arachidonic acid. That would be eggs, meat, dairy, pork. That increases the arachidonic acid. That causes inflammation, including in the intestine. But then the fat in the meat, which can be as high as 30 to 50% of the actual meat is fat, that causes the gallbladder to secrete more bile. That causes the whole intestinal system to slow down. That means that food, especially fatty food in your intestine, is coming into contact with the sensitive membranes of your stomach and intestines for a long period of time. Long. Whereas if you have a high vegan diet with good fiber, it goes right through. It goes very quickly, which then helps not only not cause colorectal cancer and inflammation, but actually reduces it substantially. So that's the mechanism. So that's why the high fiber diets and the vegan diets are much better. And finally, this is from a major study on in Taiwan, and they found that women taking pycnogenol experienced substantially fewer menopausal symptoms. And this was published in Pan Minerva Medicia, and this was done at Pescara University, and with perimenopausal women and others who are in menopause, 100 milligrams of pycnogenol taken 50 milligrams twice a day, I would say 200 milligrams taken twice a day. I think they're way under here from my experience. But it reduced oxidative stress, and it was measuring capillary blood plasma free radicals, and it made a big difference. That's just one item. What about Vioxx and Black Cohosh and Squalvine and Dong Quai? They also, taken together, can do the same. What about green vegetable juices that help rebalance the excess estrogens? And what about exercise, meditation, along with a healthy diet that not only will rebalance estrogen with progesterone, but help overcome a lot of these menopausal symptoms? They didn't have that, but this is still good news. So add one more nutrient that can make a difference. Now, I'm going to, without taking a break, I'm going to go directly into part one of our series, and then we'll take a break afterwards. This year, in the United States, we will spend approximately $3 trillion, that's $3 trillion on disease care. We call it a health care system, but we have no health in our health care system. There's no measure to prevent disease, and there's certainly no measure to help people who are sick using natural and alternative and least invasive therapies first. In 2012, America became the most over-medicated society in history. Indeed, there is a medication for every condition. And I believe that these medications will not do what we're told. We're promised they'll make us happier, slender, full of energy in it. And quite frankly, we'll look like the people on television. And the television ads are filled with people who have a problem, but after taking a specific medication, no matter how harmful the side effects, they seem happy about their condition. We're even told that we don't take enough medications as the list of made-up diseases grows longer and longer. Restless leg syndrome, social anxiety disorder, overactive bladder, prediabetes, adult ADD. We never stop to question why we need all these drugs. We never even notice that these drugs are not making us better, or that we can't get off of them once we start taking them. Why do we refuse to see that despite all these medications, we are nevertheless the sickest industrialized nation on earth? America doesn't profit from prevention. There are no preventative programs for cancer, heart disease, arthritis, dementia, Alzheimer's, or diabetes for a simple reason. It would compete with the massive profits of the medical, pharmaceutical, and insurance industries. So instead, we have become a nation of gluttons. We sublimate our anxiety and fears with comfort foods, and the government encourages it instead of offering us an honest look at cause and effect. Protecting the financial interests of the fast food industry, the makers of potato chips and soft drinks and hamburgers and steaks and desserts and genetically engineered corn and pesticides, are a compliant FDA and a completely useless USDA, whose leaders have been hand-picked by the White House to represent the interests of manufacturers. There will be no advocacy from Congress whatsoever to help the health of Americans. None. But what is the likely outcome if we continue with our current lifestyle? We're witnessing a watershed of dysfunction. The American media has assisted in creating this mythology. They've not only protected the American medical paradigm and the pharmaceutical industry, but they have actually attacked physicians, scientists, whistleblowers, chiropractors, homeopaths, medical massage therapists, meditators, anyone of the 88,000 licensed healthcare practitioners, holistic dentists, holistic nurses, who offer a non-invasive but natural way of understanding both cause and effect in treatment. They are the ones attacked by the medical bureaucratic juggernaut. As a nation, we have sunk so low as to allow our legislators to create laws based on what they are told by big business through the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, laws that mandate the worthless, dangerous, fraudulent Gardasil vaccine for girls and now boys. Or they can't go to school, and laws that require that healthcare workers get the flu vaccine or lose their jobs. All this without the majority of the media ever raising a single question. Is any of this real science? Or is this science for sale? We've decided to explore the politics of medicine and the consequences of therapies. Physicians, scientists, advisors, government agencies, the media, and a vulnerable public who are unaware of how malignant the system has become. How pernicious, widespread, and in fact endemic the self-interest, greed, and bad science actually is. Today, in part one of our in-depth original investigative reporting series, I will show that American medicine is not only broken but contributes to unnecessary injury and death into the millions of victims each year. It has morphed into an extension of the pharmaceutical industrial complex. The friendly face with white coat and the stethoscope. Let us begin now to deconstruct this myth. I begin with iatrogenic death. What is iatrogenic? It is medically induced. For anyone willing to listen, the truth is a shocker. The biggest killer of Americans isn't heart disease, it is not lung cancer, it is not stroke, and certainly it's not infectious disease. The number one killer of Americans with 600,000 to 800,000 deaths minimum per year is conventional medicine. How is this possible? What does this mean? Medicine kills in a number of ways. These are the government-owned statistics. These only statistics from peer-reviewed literature from major organizations have we used, and five scholars worked tirelessly for over 5 years to compile these figures. Adverse drug reactions, 106,000 dead. This is just 1 year. Medical errors, 98,000 dead. Bed sores, 115,000 dead. Infection, 88,000 dead. Malnutrition, 108,800 dead. Outpatients, 199,000 dead. Unnecessary procedures, 37,136 dead. Surgically related deaths, 32,000. Total, 794,936 dead Americans. Let's examine medical errors. According to a 1995 Journal of the American Medical Association report, more than 1 million patients are injured in U.S. hospitals every year. The iatrogenic death rate dwarfs the annual automobile accident rate of 45,000 and accounts for more deaths than all other accidents combined. As little as 5% and no more than 20% of iatrogenic adverse events are ever reported. This implies that if medical errors were completely and accurately reported, we would have an annual iatrogenic death rate that could be several million. The literature on medical errors is sparse and represents only the tip of the iceberg. There are autopsy studies that show rates as high as 40% of misdiagnosis causing death. One intensive care unit reported an average of 1.7 errors per day, 29% of which potentially serious or fatal. The most important reason that medical records go unreported is that doctors and nurses are unprepared to deal with human error because of the culture of medicine, which leads to covering up mistakes rather than admitting them. The one person who has done the most research on this iatrogenics topic is Dr. Lucien Lippi, who has doubtlessly published the most articles on the subject, starting in 1994. According to him, the annual death rate for hospital inpatients as of 1997 was as high as 420,000. That's back then. A survey in 1992, National Pharmacy Database, found a total of 429,827 medication errors in 1,081 hospitals. Medication errors occur in 5.22% of patients admitted to these hospitals each year. The authors conclude that at least 90,895 patients annually were harmed by medication errors in the U.S., and there doesn't seem to be any evidence that this rate has improved over the intervening years. There are many adverse effects associated with prescribing drugs across all classes. Among some of the most common prescription drugs, statins can lead to diabetes, memory loss, and crippling muscle pain. Diabetes drugs, such as Avendia and Actos, can cause increased incidence of heart attack and stroke. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can cause GI bleeding and ulceration, and a minimum of 25,000 dead each year just from antiarthritic non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like aspirin. And the COX-2 inhibitors like Vioxx and Celebrex can cause heart attack and stroke, and 60,000 died in 4 years from just Vioxx alone. Antibiotics such as Levaquin can cause tendon rupture, CNS impairment, liver failure, heart rhythm changes, and psychomembranous colitis, or even death. As Americans take more and more pharmaceuticals, death from drug overdose have more than tripled in the United States, and in 2009 killed an estimated 36,000 people. The tendency to view prescription drugs as safe leads people to take too many pills or mix them with other drugs or alcohol, which can be fatal. A lot of these overdoses involve pain medications, such as OxyContin. But it also has been found that regular use of sleeping pills have 500% increase in the risk of death compared to non-users. It is estimated that 10% of U.S. adults took sleeping pills last year. A recent study in the British Medical Journal showed that heavy sleeping pill users were almost more likely than cigarette smokers to be diagnosed with lymphomas, lung, colon, and prostate cancers. Antidepressant use has become commonplace in America, with prescriptions rising 400% since 1988. Over the past two decades, the use of antidepressant medication has grown to the point that they are now the third most commonly prescribed class of medications in the United States and the most frequently used medication by people 18 to 44. By gender, 23% are women, ages 40 to 59, taking antidepressants. So what's fueling this epidemic of antidepressant use? The pharmaceutical companies spend billions of dollars annually to market their drugs through sending drug representatives to meet with doctors face-to-face, through continuing medical education, articles and journals, and direct-to-consumer advertising. Doctors are bombarded with advertisements for antidepressants, as are the American people, every time they turn on the television or pick up a newspaper or magazine. There has been a large-scale effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry to persuade everyone that our brains are abnormal in their natural state and we need medication to correct a mythical, completely fraudulent, non-scientific chemical imbalance. The researchers have not studied normal balance in the brain, and the chemical imbalance theory is completely untested, unproven quackery. Yet the campaign has been extremely effective and very lucrative for healthcare providers and the pharmaceutical companies. Much of this growth in psychiatric prescribing, in fact, has been driven by a substantial increase in antidepressant prescriptions by non-psychiatric providers without an accompanying psychiatric diagnosis. Between 1996 and 2007, the proportion of visits at which antidepressants were prescribed by non-psychiatric diagnosis increased to 72%. We feel bad, and we want to feel better immediately without examining why we feel bad in the first place. But these tricyclic antidepressants, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and antipsychotics all have side effects and will damage a normal brain over time. The most well-regarded studies have shown that antidepressants don't work much better than a placebo in relieving depression. Amazingly, the drug companies have been able to convince the American public that it is a medically sound premise to prescribe medication that might offer short-term relief, but will definitely harm in the long term, and the short-term relief is mostly placebo. People wanting to believe that the drug will help, wanting to believe that the psychiatrist or doctor giving it has got their best interest, rather than the actual ingredients in the drug, which don't work. And people find out the hard way that once you start taking an antidepressant, you cannot then discontinue it because the withdrawal is unbearable. So sometimes people are hooked for life. That is part one. Now, you're going to hear a pharmaceutical rep. Here's how your doctor ends up prescribing toxic, non-scientifically validated drugs, making a lot of money for themselves, but making billions for the pharmaceutical industry.
My name is Gwen Olson, and I am the author of Confessions of an Rx Drug Pusher. I'm a 15-year veteran of the pharmaceutical industry, and I left in the year 2000. And what I would like to do today is I would like to dispel the myth that the pharmaceutical industry is in the business of health and healing. Because in fact, what the pharmaceutical industry is in the business of doing is disease maintenance and symptoms management. They are not in the business to cure cancer, to cure Alzheimer's, to cure heart disease, because if they were, they would be in the business of putting themselves out of business, and that in fact doesn't make sense. I don't want people thinking that I am a conspiracy theorist, because in fact there is no theory behind what I'm telling you. It's all provable. And what I'm saying is provable is that the pharmaceutical industry doesn't want to cure people. You need to understand, specifically when we're talking about psychiatric drugs in particular, that these are drugs that encourage people to remain customers of the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, you will be told if you're given a drug such as an anxiolytic or an antidepressant or an antipsychotic drug that you may be on the drug for the rest of your life. And very frequently, people find that they are on the drugs for a very long period of time, if not permanently, because they're almost impossible to get off of. Some of them can have very serious withdrawal symptoms, and most of them can have extremely serious withdrawal symptoms if they're stopped cold turkey, but some people even experience withdrawal symptoms when they try to titrate or they try to eliminate the drug little by little, day after day. So it's really important to understand the motivation behind all of the current maintenance drugs that are on the market, even, for example, drugs such as cholesterol-lowering drugs. And what we are in fact finding now is that cholesterol drugs are lowering cholesterol excessively and causing other disease states as a consequence. So you need to be careful about trying to take drugs in order to remain healthy, because you're never going to have anyone come to you and tell you that the drugs are always tried against a placebo in clinical trials. What a placebo is a sugar pill. And in fact, many drugs are not found to be much more efficacious than the sugar pill. And in a case in point, actually, is the recent clinical trials that were released in the meta-analysis that came out of the UK on antidepressants, on the newer SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants. And what was found was the information that activists and other researchers have known for decades, was that antidepressants are no more effective than placebo, no more effective than sugar pills. But yet there are over 44 million people that have been taking these antidepressants, and a large number of them people that have mild to moderate depressive episodes. In fact, they prove that the antidepressants were not effective in anyone with the exception of some of the most severely depressed patients. And I can tell you from personal experience that there are a number of things that depressed patients can do to improve their mental status aside from drugs that are quite effective and, in fact, more effective than placebo. Another recent study that was released showed that exercise was, in fact, more effective than either placebo or the antidepressant drug that they were compared to. But just like Bill Maher said in his show, you know, we're never going to hear any ads on television that are sponsored by anybody saying, you know, the New England Journal just announced that exercise is twice as effective as antidepressants in curing depression. Ask your doctor if getting your butt off the couch is right for you. You know, you're never going to get that kind of good information, fair, balanced information, as long as pharma is funding the major TV stations, the advertising that supports those television stations, the major journals, and all of the advertising that supports the major journals. You just have to be commonsensical, people, and understand that the pharmaceutical industry makes 5 to 6 times the amount of money as any of the other Fortune 500 companies in the United States of America. They are not going to easily or readily give up that income. And we are, in fact, considered a human commodity. Our loved ones, our children, our elderly are considered cash cows that are preyed upon by pharmaceutical reps such as myself, who are encouraged to go in and build market shares without thinking about the consequences to patients, without knowing the misinformation that they are distributing, without being aware that the clinical data has been contrived or that the patient populations have been cherry-picked or that the side effects have been minimized and reported in such a manner that it doesn't present the information correctly. I spent 15 years in this industry. I was one of the best, but I'm here to tell you that the industry has run amok, that we are at a severe crossroads in this nation, and that we have got to take our power back, and we have got to start making the pharmaceutical industry accountable for their actions and for the defective products that they're putting on the market. It won't be long before every American is affected by this disaster, and we need to be aware of what the differences are between diseases, between disorders, and between syndromes, because if it doesn't have to be scientifically proven, if there are no tests, if there are no blood tests, CAT scans, urine tests, MRIs, if there is nothing to document that you have a disease, then you, in fact, do not have a disease. You have a disorder, and it has been given and has been diagnosed pretentiously, and you need to get yourself educated and understand that there are options, and those options are much more effective than drugs. You need to look into the nutritional aspects of your diet and your lifestyle aspects. Are you exercising? Are you taking care of yourself in the ways that you need to be proactive about your health? Because once you start down the road of taking one prescription drug on top of the other, you will be a lifelong customer for the pharmaceutical industry, and your choices will be truncated. So I would like to ask you to please self-educate, be proactive, and share the information with others. The next victim could be someone that you love.
And in fact, you will hear how many victims we have each year. And I will be doing a national campaign to help people in different areas so we can take back our health starting in June, a very national campaign. You'll see what's coming. Now, let's go over before we go to our commentary of the day and say hello to Marilyn Ellie. She is an anti-nuclear activist for 18 years. She is on the steering committee of the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition, which is a coalition of environmental, health, and public policy organizations opposing continued operation of the Indian Point nuclear reactor on the Hudson River. She is also the co-founder of the Westchester Citizens Awareness Network and a member of Clear Water. Nice to have you with us today, Ellie.
Well, thank you so much, Gary. It's wonderful to be here. I really appreciate it.
Okay, we don't have but a minute here. Let's talk about what we have planned for this Sunday and demonstrating, and I'm asking everyone in this audience to please come and join with us as we protest against Indian Point Nuclear Plant. There's going to be a rally at Indian Point this Sunday at 3:30 when we're going to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. Please be at the gates of Indian Point at 3:30. But anyone interested in carpooling, we have a lot of people who want to come who don't have cars. So if you have a car, please come by our call us and let us know so we can then match up your car with some of the people who want to come. Our number is 626-926-5422. If you just call that number, then we'll match people with cars. We need cars right now. We're meeting at 83rd and Broadway at 1:30. Now tell us who's going to be there and what they can expect.
Well, it's a vigil. We are standing in solidarity with the people of Japan. We've had 5 experts in from Fukushima, and the stories are just heartbreaking about what's happening. We want to be in solidarity with them, and we will have a moment of silence at 3:36, which is when the disaster happened 1 year ago. Harvey Wasserman will be there. For those of you in their audience who are longtime activists, Connie Hogarth will be there. We will have a representative from Riverkeeper, and of course, we're really looking forward to having you come and talk about the health problems that generate from that nuclear power plant. And after that, I invite people to come to our potluck, which is just down the road from where we're meeting. And we have a commemorative program at 6 o'clock where we will have music and we will have poetry and we'll have the voices of Fukushima. Vigil is going to be held, and it's going to be led by Junsan Yoshida, who's a Buddhist nun. And it'll be in the Buddhist tradition, but everyone is welcome. We're bringing peace grains. In that tradition, it's customary to do an offering. So many of our people are making peace grains and bringing extras so that everyone can have a peace grain to put in the offering.
Where should people meet who have cars? Because 99% of the people coming from this audience will have cars driving in from Long Island and Connecticut and New Jersey. Where do they go first?
Well, they need to come. It's Broadway and Bleakley is the intersection where we're having our gathering.
Broadway and Bleakley, where?
In Buchanan, New York.
And how far is that from New York City?
It's about 25 miles from New York.
Okay, good. Then they can look it up on MapQuest.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Give that address one more time, please.
It's the corner of the intersection of Bleakley and Broadway.
And in the town of
Buchanan, New York.
Buchanan, New York.
Yeah.
Thank you. We will be there this Sunday, and I know a lot of people in this audience, Marilyn, will be there to support closing Indian Point.
And standing vigil.
Yes.
For the triple tragedy. Gary, thank you so much.
I look forward to being there. Thank you. All right. I'm looking forward to a lot of people in this audience joining us there. Remember, anything happens at a nuclear facility, everyone is going to be hurt. So everyone should be concerned. Let us show that by joining together. Now for a special commentary. Americans seem confident in the mythical notion that the United States is a free nation dedicated to reproducing the principles of equality, justice, and democracy. What has been ignored in this delusional view is the growing rise of an expanded national security state since 2001, and an attack on individual rights that suggests the United States has more in common with authoritarian regimes like China and Iran than anyone would like to admit. I want to address this seemingly untenable notion that the United States has become a breeding ground for authoritarianism by focusing on 4 fundamentalisms: market fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, educational fundamentalism, and military fundamentalism. This is far from an exhaustive list, but it does raise serious questions about how the claim to democracy in the United States has been severely damaged, if not made impossible. The broader contours of the attack on democratic freedoms have become obvious in recent years. While the Bush administration engaged in torture and shamelessly violated civil liberties and put a host of Christian extremists in high-ranking governmental positions, the Obama administration has not only continued many of these policies, but has further institutionalized them. As Glenn Greenwald has reminded us, Obama has continued the Bush-Cheney terrorism and civil liberties policies, further undermining constitutional rights by promoting indefinite detention, weakening the rights of habeas corpus for prisoners in Afghanistan and elsewhere, extending government power through the state secrets privilege, asserting the right to target American citizens for assassination, and waging war on whistleblowers. More specifically, there are the ongoing revelations about the Obama administration's decision under the National Defense Authorization Act to allow American citizens to be held indefinitely without charge or trial. The government's increased role in using special operational forces and drones, 30,000 will now be deployed over the United States. In targeted assassinations, the emergence and use of sophisticated surveillance technologies to spy on protesters, the invocation of the state secrecy practices, the suspension of civil liberties that allow various government agencies to spy on Americans without first obtaining warrants, and the stories about widespread abuse of and torture by the U.S. military in Afghanistan, not to mention the popular support for torture among the American public. It gets worse. As the war on terror degenerated in a war on democracy, a host of legal illegalities have been established that put the rule of law, if not the very principle of Western jurisprudence, into a chokehold. How such assaults on the rule of law, justice, and democracy could take place without massive resistance represents one of the most reprehensible moments in American history. Most Americans caught in the grip of simply trying to survive, or paralyzed in a relentless culture of fear, ignored the assaults on democracy unleashed by a growing national security state. The assaults loom large and are evident in the passage of the Use of Military Force Act, the passage of the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, the Military Commissions Act, and the National Defense Authorization Act. Jim Garrison rightly raises the question about whether these acts inspired by 9/11 and the war on terror are worth sacrificing the Republic for. The rise of the national security state is no longer an abstraction. It can only be seen in the collapse of the traditional distinction between the military and the police, as weapons move freely from the military to local police forces and contribute to the rise of pervasive police abuse against students, African Americans, and immigrants. We also have to include in this list a growing culture of manufactured indifference and cruelty intensified through a commercially driven spectacle of violence that saturates every element of American society. The latter intensified daily by a language of hate aimed indiscriminately by the right wing and the left wing, many conservative politicians and liberal politicians, and an army of anti-public pundits against those who suffer from a number of misfortunes, including unemployment, inadequate health care, poverty, and homelessness. Think of Rush Limbaugh's cruel and hateful attack on Sandra Fluke, insisting that she was a prostitute because she believed that contraception was a woman's right and should be covered by insurance companies as part of her health coverage. Or for that matter, think about the ongoing attempts on the part of the Republican politicians to cut food stamp programs that benefit over 45 million people. Friends, do you know any politician in Washington? Do you know any lobbyist? Do you know any major Fortune 500 corporate executive, board of director member, or employees that are on food stamps, who've lost their homes, who are couch surfing? Do you know any of their children who are suffering from malnutrition? I'll show you 12 million children who are not given any food each day, as indifference permeates every side of this discussion. Another would call the elimination of child labor laws something to be proud of. We should never be proud of putting children to work. But listen to the discussions. Jonathan Schell highlights how this culture of cruelty manifests itself in a steadily growing faith and force as the solution to almost any problem, whether at home or abroad. The governing through crime model that now imposes violence on school children all across the country is a particularly egregious example. How else to explain that in just last year, the police gave close to 300,000 Class C misdemeanor tickets to children as young as 6 years old just in Texas for offenses in and out of school, which result in fines, community service, and prison time. Behavior as trivial as a dress violation. Or Katie Simpkins insists and look at classrooms where a child is late to class and now is criminalized. This is symptomatic of what is now going on, a growing trend in which, quote, we have taken children and childhood behavior and made it a crime. All of these violations point to the ongoing and growing fundamentalism and rule of exceptions in the American polity that bear witness to the growing authoritarianism in American life. Those governing the United States no longer have a moral compass or a democratic vision, nor do they have a hold on the social values that would engage modes of governance beneficial to the broader public. Governance is now in the hands of corporate power, and the United States increasingly exhibits all the characteristics of a failed state. As many notable and courageous critics, ranging from Sheldon Rowland to Chris Hedges, have pointed out, American politics is being shaped by extremists who have shredded civil liberties, lied to the public to legitimize their sending young American troops to Iraq and Afghanistan, alienated most of the international community with their blatant exercise of arrogant power and investment in a permanent warfare state, tarnished the highest offices of government with unsavory corporate alliances, used political power to unabashedly pursue legislative policies that favor the rich and punish the poor, and perhaps irreparably damage any remaining public sphere not governed by the logic of the market. They have waged a covert war against poor, young people and people of color who are being either warehoused in some substandard schools or incarcerated at alarming rates. Academic freedom is increasingly under attack by extremists such as Rick Santorum. Homophobia and racism have become the poster ideologies of the Republican Party. War and warriors have become the most endearing models of national greatness, and a full-fledged assault on women's reproductive rights is being championed by the current crop of Republicans and presidential hopefuls, and not an insignificant number of Republican governors and Democrats, while people of color, the poor, youth in the middle class, the elderly, and communities, women, are being attacked. Why? And where are the liberal class in protecting them? So let us go to these simple fundamentalisms. Market fundamentalism is our first. A number of powerful anti-democratic tendencies now threaten American democracy, and at least four of these are guaranteed to entail grave social and economic consequences. The first is a market fundamentalism that not only trivializes democratic values and public concerns, but also enshrines a rabid individualism, an all-embracing quest for profits, and a social Darwinism in which misfortune is seen as a weakness and a Hobbesian war of all against all. Replaces any vestige of shared responsibilities or compassion for others. Free market fundamentalists now wage a full-scale attack on social contract, the state welfare, and any notion of the common good in those public spheres not yet defined by commercial interest. Within neoliberal ideology, the market becomes the template for organizing the rest of society. Everyone is now a consumer or client, and every relationship is ultimately judged in bottom-line, cost-effective terms. Freedom is no longer equality, social justice, or public welfare, but about the trading goods, financial capital, and commodities. As market fundamentalism ensures that the logic of capital trumps democratic sovereignty, low-intensity warfare at home chips away at democratic freedoms, while high-intensity warfare abroad delivers democracy with bombs, tanks, and chemical warfare. The cost abroad is massive human suffering and death, and as Paul Krugman points out, the hijacking of public policy by private interests parallels the downward spiral in governance. In the land of the isolated individual, everything is privatized and public issues collapsed into individual concerns that there is no way of linking private woes to social problems. The result is a dog-eat-dog war. Moreover, when all things formally link to the public good, then the commons are so aggressively individualized and commodified and commercialized, it leaves few places in which a critical language and democratic values can be developed to defend institutions as vital public spheres. And then you have religious fundamentalism. The second fundamentalism is seen in a religious fervor embraced by the Republican Party that not only serves up creationism instead of science, but substitutes unthinking faith for critical reason and intolerance for a concern with and a openness towards others. This is a deeply disturbing trend in which the line between the state and religion is being erased as radical Christians and evangelicals embrace and impose a moralism on Americans that is largely bigoted, patriarchal, uncritical, insensitive to real social problems such as poverty, racism, and the crisis in health care, and in the increasing impoverishment of Americans' children. Instead of addressing these real problems, a flock of dangerous and powerful religious fanatics who have enormous political clout are waging a campaign to ban same-sex marriages, undermine scientific knowledge, eliminate important research initiatives such as those involving embryonic cells, stem cell, deny the human destruction of the environmental system, overturn Roe v. Wade, and ban contraception for women. For those of you who are only listening to 1 hour or 55 minutes of our program, I thank you for listening. For those of you who continue listening over the internet or listening by calling 832-280-0066, I will continue and finish this dialogue. Then we turn to educational fundamentalism. This is the third related anti-democratic dogma, and it is virulent. It is anti-intellectualism, visible in the relentless attempt on the part of the Obama administration and his Republican Party allies to destroy critical thinking. Critical education is a foundation for an engaged citizenry and a vibrant democracy. The attack on all levels of education is evident in the attempts to corporatize education, standardize curricula, privatize public schooling, and use the language of business as a model for governance. It is equally evident in the ongoing effort to weaken the autonomy of higher education, undercut the power of faculty, and turn full-time academic jobs into contractual labor. Public schools are increasingly reduced to training grounds and modeling after prisons, with an emphasis on criminalizing student behavior and privatizing security over critical learning. Across the board, educators are now viewed largely as de-skilled technicians, depoliticized professionals, paramilitary forces, hawkers for corporate goods, or money and grant chasers. At the same time as democracy is removed from the purpose and meaning of schooling, those larger educational forces in the culture are handing over to a small group of corporate interests. The dominant media engage in a form of public power mongering that appears to legitimize dominant power rather than hold it accountable to any ethical or political standard. And finally, we have military fundamentalism, the fourth anti-democratic dogma that is shaping American life, and one of the most disturbing to me is the ongoing militarization of public life. Americans are not only obsessed with military power, it has become central to our national identity. What other explanation can there be for the fact that the United States has over 725 official military bases outside the country and 969 at home? Or that it spends more on defense than all the rest of the world put together. As Tony Judt states emphatically, quote, "This country is obsessed with war, rumors of war, images of war, preemptive war, preventative war, surgical war, prophylactic war, permanent war." War is no longer a state of exception, but a permanent driving force in American domestic and foreign policy. Cornel West points out that such aggressive militarism is fashioned out of an ideology that supports foreign policy based on the cowboy mythology of the American frontier fantasy, while also producing domestic policy that expands police power, augments the prison-industrial complex, and legitimizes unchecked male power and violence at home and the workplace. It views crime as a monstrous enemy to crush, targeting poor people rather than an ugly behavior to change by addressing the condition that often encourage such behavior. In conclusion, in opposition to the rising tide of authoritarianism, there is a need for a vast social movement capable of challenging the basic premises of an ever-expanding, systematic attack on democracy. The elements of authoritarianism must be made visible, not simply as concepts, but as practices. The Occupy movement and others arising in its wake need to build a network of new institutions that can offer a different language, history, and set of values, knowledge, and ideas. There is a need for free schools, universities, public spheres, and other spaces where learning can be connected to social change and understanding translated into the building of social movements. As I've written many times, young people, parents, community workers, educated artists, and others must make a case for linking learning to social change. Changing consciousness is not the same as altering the institutional basis of oppression. But at the same time, institutional reform cannot take place without a change in consciousness that recognizes the very need of such reform and the need to reinvent the conditions and practices that would make it possible. In addition, it is crucial to raise questions about the relationship between power and civic culture. What would it take for individuals and social groups to believe they have a responsibility to address the realities of class, gender oppression, race, and other specific forms of domination. For too long, those on the left have ignored that the issue of politics as a strategy is connected to the issue of political education and entangled with power, ideologies, values, the acquisition of agency, and the visions of the future. Fortunately, power is never completely on the side of the domination and religious fanaticism and political corruption, nor is it entirely in the hands of those who view democracy as an excess or burden. Increasingly, more and more individuals and groups at home and around the globe, including students, workers, feminists, educators, writers, environmentalists, senior citizens, artists, and a host of other individuals and movements, are organizing to challenge the dangerous slide on the part of the United States into the morass of an authoritarianism that threatens not just the promise, but the very idea of democracy in the 21st century. I'm Gary Knoll, and I thank you very much for listening. Professor Henry Giroux, Truth Out. Have a good day.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't.